Cliff Ransom, Ransom Research. Norm, we've been talking for an awful long time about the refleeting of the North American legacy carriers. We sort of thought it might happen, and then we hit 08-09.
Right.
We've now had, or about to have, 2 years of reasonable productivity, reasonable profitability.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going to get them off the dime?
Well, high fuel prices, and you've got 2 more years of aging, and you've got some new products coming out with the Neo. And I'm not saying the entire 2,000 planes will go away, but I think you're going to see some campaign activity there.
Will it be meaningful in 12?
Well, no, this will be probably more filling out lines in sort of 14 and beyond.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just had a couple of questions on the narrow body approach in commercial engines. One was, I guess, what your view is on the gap between, when your LEAP product can come out sort of into service versus the geared turbofan. You know, some people are saying it's a 2 year plus window that the geared turbofan has, just kind of an update on that. And then secondly, what you're doing if you see an upgraded geared turbofan, what your plan is to deal with that, because obviously there's talk around an extra 5 points of fuel efficiency coming on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of delay, and Chip, I'll let you chime in here, the 2 year delay between the two is intriguing to us. On the Neo, the difference is 6 to 8 months between our entry into service and the entry into service of the geared turbofan. So on a head-to-head to competition on an A320 Neo, our entry into service will be 6 to 8 months, which is pretty traditional. Quite frankly, when you have two engines on the airplane, one goes first, certifies the airplane, the second one certifies second. So there's, to me, I don't see any difference in how we're running the Neo program than we would any other airplane with competing engines that both need to be certified, both in terms of the engines and the airplane applications.
No different than the 787 or any other engine choice program. It's driven by workload at the airframer and getting the two different airplane configurations certified and flight test.
Right, and then in terms of technology, the story I just told you on the CFM56-7 is exactly the history of the CFM program. Every time we run one of these E-Core technology demonstrator programs, we're doing it today with E-Core based on the next evolution of the GEnx core. That'll go into LEAP. We'll then run that core again. We'll get more aerodynamic efficiency, and we'll drive it back into the installed base. As of July, we're putting 2 points of more fuel burn into the existing CFM56-7 on the next-gen 737. That's not an uncommon thing. It's all about a commitment to the investment in technology. And I'll tell you, if you take a look at our track record over the last 25, 30 years in terms of ensuring we have that investment on the wide bodies as well as the regional jets all the way down, and making sure that we know how to roll that investment into upgrades, we're very enthusiastic and very incentivized to do so. So I feel really comfortable both with the architecture of the engine as well as our positioning and technology on the engine. Nicole.
David, could you give us a sense? I mean, you alluded to R&D spend staying at the sort of 1.3 to 5 level, 1.3 to 1.5 level. As you sort of think about the opportunities beyond that, the split between engines and systems, and then also how you see that playing out. I mean, are we at a new sort of run rate just given the investment that you're going to continue to do to just grow the install base?
We've made some commitments on the installed base, as we've talked about, with the CF34 on the global, so that means that product's going to go forward with the certification schedule. Once we make that commitment to one engine, you'd love to get another application for it, because the game is installed base growth, Nicole. So, we're actively looking for another application for that CF34. We may have to do a design of the fan and turbine when we do it, which would then means that would have to be included in the research and development budget. I'd love to have another application for the LEAP technology, as we all know, depending on what happens on the 737. So depending on when and what happens on the 737, we may find that we have another opportunity to put LEAP on a third application. Similarly, on GEnx, I don't see a whole lot more. We're going into service with the best technology we know how to. So it's all about our first impression with the customers and what that installed base grows as, and making sure we've got great customer support. And the GE90, we're starting the technology advancement programs on that now, but I don't see that ramping up until after 2015. To be very frank with it, maybe some work in 20, heavy work, core kind of work in 2014. kind of time frame. So I think we're pretty stable on where we are on the research and development spend, probably through 2015. And then we'll just have to see how successful we are with finding more airplanes to put these engines on, which, trust me, every day Chip's charged with go finding another airplane to put these engines on once we decide to make the investment in doing the total development in that thrust class.
And just a follow-up for Norm, just on residual values, as we think about the percentage of your fleet that's narrow-body and we think about the new technology that's coming on, what's the outlook for residual values in your portfolio?
You know, it's basically with these new technologies, let's focus on the NEO. It's a phased impact over many years. You know, when you look at the 320 family, it'll probably be about 6,500 units in like 2016 or so. And so even if you're producing about 500 a year, it'll take literally 10 years to get to the parity point. So, you know, sitting here in 2011, it'll have some impact, but it's phased and steady. As you get to mid-teens and last of the line, it'll have a bigger impact, and we just have to factor that into our curves.
David, question on the revenue outlook first. You know, the 8% CAGR over the last 5 years, what was military in that context? And then, you know, as you look out over the next 5 years relative to the 8%, up, down, similar, and how do you think of military in that context? First question.
You know, we think of the military business as being very stable. We love our position in the installed base. You saw what we're doing to try to get the upgrades. We see a transition from new platforms to upgrades. So I feel very comfortable about our position. I think that revenue line is stable. It'll move as the total environment moves. We hope to do better than the budget by quite a bit in terms of growth, based on the positioning we have in the installed base. The wild card on the military is the F-136 and what we do going forward with that, as you know. But if you put that aside and just look apples to apples on where we are, you know, I think we've got some positive growth because that installed base is going to grow in every one of those segments. I do think we're going to have much more focus on research and development and also on affordable upgrades, because I think that value proposition is where the military's got to go so they get a bigger bang for their dollar, you know, going forward. And I think that gives us a chance to really exploit the installed base and find value.
I would just say that the, I don't know the CAGR, but the military business has grown about 2x over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So then in terms of the overall business, you know, I think you should, you know, for me, just about where we've seen the last five is not a bad place, you know, as I take a look at it. You know, both in terms of research and development as well as that installed base coming in, you know, 52% of those CFMs haven't seen their first shop visit, so certainly we get the opportunity for those coming in.
Okay. And then as a follow-up, you know, the walk to stronger profit growth in 2012 versus 11.
Yeah.
R&D flat, productivity up a couple points again, presumably.
Yeah.
More growth in aftermarket. Anything else in that mix you want to highlight?
No, that's really the big three. You know, more growth in aftermarket, driving productivity. You know, productivity is great when volume's going up. It's a night, you know, you make hay when the sun shines. So it's time to drive the productivity hard, and we will. And with R&D flat, productivity up, and then the volume going up in the aftermarket, it gives us a nice opportunities. And we kind of know where our R&D is going to be, and we kind of. You know, can do the math on how this thing is going to play out over the next couple of years.
I had a question just to follow up on that F-136 comment. Is that in your 1.3 to 1.5 billion in terms of R&D on an annual basis? And how long do you think about continuing to self-fund that? How much is left to spend?
Yeah, you know, the way we think of it is, you know, first of all, we really believe that a program of this size needs competing engines, as we've been very public in our discussion, not just us, but that goes all the way up through Jeff and the board. We've decided to do the self-funding for 2011 and 12 so that we could demonstrate how committed we were, and also we want to run the engines. We want to run three engines over this time frame to, again, be able to show the performance data on the motor, so that we can show that it does differentiate itself and have differentiated value in the airplane. We expect to have to contribute to the program all the way through its production. How much that contribution, and depends on what the timeline is on the overall program, which is moving as we speak. And so, you know, the 1.3 to 1.5 contemplates us participating in the F-136 as it goes forward. But the exact amount will be dependent on where the airplane goes and how delayed the, you know, the variants are, whether it be the STOVL variant or the CTOL variant, and we'll adjust accordingly. But we do expect, as part of this acquisition reform, that there will be a percentage of that that we need to participate in. And we think that's the beginning of acquisition reform. We also believe in fixed price. You know, we were the first ones to offer fixed price on that program now 3 years ago as our first offer as a way of trying to find affordability for it to fit underneath the existing pressures in the defense budget. So we'll continue to push on acquisition sharing as well as fixed pricing for the engine as a way of making, in addition to the value that the engine can bring to the airplane from a competitive perspective.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kai Von Rumor from Cowan and Company. Follow up on the F-136. While you're self-funding it, are you self-funding it as IR&D and therefore is some of it recoverable as an allowable cost, or is it totally on your nickel?
I think it's fair to say it's completely on our nickel. It will be on an unallowable expense as we move forward with the investment that David discussed through fiscal year 12.
And then on the 787, you know, your competitor's engine has not yet been certified on the aircraft. When do you expect your engine to be certified on the aircraft, and approximately how many deliveries of 787s with GE engines do you expect this year? Because you said you expect to deliver some in the fourth quarter.
Do we have an estimate of deliveries this year at Jowney? Yeah. What is it approximately? It's for us or for the total? Total, yeah. So, you know, total 787s delivered in 2011, and Boeing, this is right. A Boeing number, you know, think of somewhere around 20 airplanes, right? So we think our certification will be in the fourth quarter of this year for the airplane engine combination. You know, I tell you, I'm very bullish on the progress that Boeing is making on the certification tests, both on the Rolls airplane today as well as on ours. So I think they've done a very nice job of getting the majority of the issues they've had in certification behind them. They're clicking these tests off quickly, as they are on the 747-8. And we have a great level of confidence that we're going to be in service both with the 78 and the 74 this year. And so we're preparing, you know, the customer and product support network, even though it's a small number of planes, to make sure that the first impression of this airplane at Air India and JAL is as extraordinary as the airplane itself is.
Okay, and then a number of your competitors and other suppliers have been talking about the strength in the aftermarket. Goodrich, I think, recently said, you know, higher in the second quarter year over year than in the first quarter. Pratt's been talking about continuing strength. Just give us some color in terms of your aftermarket. You seeing near-term trends the same, greater strength?
No, I would, you know, I showed you 4% growth in shop visits year over year, 2011 to 2012. I think it's fair to say that that is greater in the second half of the year as it is in the first half of the year. And so, you know, we normally expect a 6 to 8 month delay in recovery versus the airlines. If you think about it, you know, our recovery comes when the service recovers. And that's normally a lag of somewhere around 8 months from when we start seeing demand for the airlines start. So if you think about 8 months ago where the airlines were in terms of their recovery, it gives you some anticipation. Now, their recovery is still growing at 5.5% this year, 4.5 to 5.5. And so we expect to see recovering in the services accordingly, you know. And what keeps us all on watch is what happens with oil. So we all look at the oil expense. Because the first thing they'll do is start to delay some of the maintenance on the engines and airplanes in order to kind of button down the hatches. So we watch oil very carefully as an indicator of utilization as well as servicing. But I would say that we're bullish about where we are in the second half of this year versus the first half.
Terrific. Thank you.
Yep.
Norm, just a follow-up question for you on residual values. We're hearing from some other lessors and appraisers that Airbus 10-year-old narrow bodies are under a lot more pressure right now in the marketplace versus the Boeing narrow body product. I'm wondering if you're seeing that in your portfolio.
Well, vintage in general, you know, coming out of a down cycle, you always see a bit of pressure no matter what type. So that'll start to shift as you get more into the up cycle. But yeah, I think it's fair to say 10 plus year equipment is is harder to place out there than, you know, brand new or within a five-year vintage.
But any difference between Airbus and Boeing products, specifically in results of the in relation to the Neo and so forth, that there's been more pressure on the Airbus product line in the leasing market?
Well, I think it's more supply. It's less Neo-driven. It's more lessor supply of Airbus versus Boeing. If you look in the next few years, there's about 230 lessor slots. Airbus side, Boeing's like 130. So just pure, there's more lessor slots on the Airbus. That's sort of driving rentals a little bit lower than the Boeing side.
Okay. Thank you.
David, so it looks like the new engines, LeapX, GTF, are promising lower maintenance costs over the life cycle of the engine, which seems to indicate that the economics of the engine business have to change, i.e. more money up front, less money on the back end. Would you agree with that statement? And does the pricing on the new engine awards we've seen support that statement?
Well, anytime you launch a new program, you know, and being someone who launched GNX and now is launching Leap, you know, you're careful. You know, the first airlines that buy these engines and airplane combinations are doing it because they know that they're incentivized to be a launch customer. So over this whole launch period, we've been very cautious about how we've played this hand. And I think you'll see at the end of this week that our order book is going to be pretty strong. But there's been a very cautious step forward. In fact, Chip's done a terrific job of making sure that we are very conscious of the overall economics of these deals as we move forward in the launch. You know, it's we're going to sell a lot of Leap, and they're going to sell a lot of Geared Fan because this is a big market. You know, narrow bodies are a big market. The launch customers are going to come in, and they're going to want to be incentivized to launch, and you just have to be very careful that you can handle the economics of that, and we have been. That's why we started out of the gate so slow, if you remember. But I think in general, with the level of efficiencies, if you take a look at the value proposition that we can bring an airline today with a 15% better fuel burn, with oil at $130 a barrel, it's a significant savings. And we certainly expect in the price of the engine to be rewarded on that up front, as I assume Pratt does, both of us do. And so it will balance the entire cost of ownership versus the model we have today. I think that's a valid point. Oh.
Hi, we're getting ready to build a lot of engines, which I'm sure is exciting, but I wondered if you could just share with us your thoughts about the challenges that you might, you know, have to do to get ready to do this, sort of what you've done, where you see the stuff that looks easy and where the stuff that looks a little more challenging.
Well, you know, on the production rates of what we're building today, it's kind of nice because you have a learning curve associated with them, right? So the CF-34s, we've been in production for a while, CFMs. The GNXs, which we're now going into service, you can imagine we're going down a learning curve on those, both in terms of our productivity and producing the engine, as well as the cost as we get more volume in the shops. I'm actually really looking forward to that, to be very honest. The technical challenges on building the engines, I feel pretty comfortable about. We manage the supply chain closer than we ever have before. I spend more time in operational reviews with the supply chain to ensure readiness. We manage material like titanium and nickel and some of these exotic alloys in the blades all the way down to the mines. We really do. We know by pound, based on our order book and our delivery schedules, exactly how much we need of everything. Nickel, titanium, you name it. And we make sure that we secure those positions all the way down to the mines so that we don't run. And that includes both our spare parts with the services growth, because that's equally as big a deal, especially life-limited parts when the big discs come out, as new production. So, you know, the operational disciplines that exist in the business are at an all-time high so that we can have that installed base and ensure that we can deliver production plus that installed base. It's a big piece of my time, bigger than it was 3 years ago for sure. And I feel pretty comfortable with it, and especially keep an eye on materials. You know, we just have to have a good material strategy and make sure we've got good materials delivery, and we do. Well, nickel yesterday broke below 10, so it was $9.63, not that I know it, but and that was kind of exciting, to be very honest with you. I'm sure not for many in this room, but for me, it was a big day. So, you know, we are watching very carefully. You can imagine the amount of nickel-based alloys we use. It's a big deal for us. You know, it's our oil, right? Nickel is our oil in our business. So we watch very carefully and make sure we've got the right strategies on raw materials. And I was pleasantly surprised when, you know, when nickel fell below 10, to be really blunt about it.
Thanks, good morning. Can you tell us what will drive the next step reduction in fuel burn? Is it advanced materials, manufacturing technology, airfoil efficiency?
I think it's all three. I think, you know, I think the material suite in the engines is more and more important. You know, as we take a look at the use of composites in hot sections through these ceramic matrix designs that we're looking at now for the next generation, tremendous opportunity there, but also a tremendous challenge in manufacturing technologies to be ready for that. The discussion I gave you earlier on the impact of the leverage of a global research center, there's no place that that plays out more than in this kind of a discussion. So you look at the energy business, looking at how it stays competitive in its land-based turbines, and it's looking at these same material systems that we are. So the amount of research we're doing on some of the new materials and aerodynamics, new materials for ceramic matrix, some of the new alloys we need, both nickel base as well as titanium base, and new casting processes we use. In addition to aerodynamic modeling and the idea for us to understand the aerodynamics and coatings, which is another big thing, whether they're, you know, thermal coatings for hot sections or coatings for water resistance, isophobic coatings that actually avoid water from smearing and therefore avoid icing. There's just a tremendous amount of technology that goes into this. So I don't think it's one thing. I think the manufacturing technologies are necessary so that we can afford to put these materials in the engine. So it's materials and aerodynamics and then manufacturing technologies and scale that guarantee us that we can bring it to market at a price that we can afford.
Thanks. And last, is open rotor still alive at all? Or?
Yeah, we're looking at it very closely. And I would say we're very interested in the open rotor. We think the time frame for it is longer. We made great progress on noise. We really have on the open rotor. And I'm very enthusiastic about the noise signature. So we continue to study open rotor. In fact, the noise signature, not just for open rotor, but, you know, Norm mentioned and Chip's working on, we also have a few projects in turboprops. And, you know, we own a propeller company, Dowdy, and the advanced technologies that we can bring to that propeller company through aerodynamics as well as noise reductions, we're taking a look at the next generation of these turboprops for under 500 nautical miles because that may be a big market in the future. So we want to make sure we're prepared for it.
The R&D range for 2011-2012, 1.3 to 1.5, is a reasonably big range. What is the big variance between the low end and the high end? Is it the launch costs or is it actual program development costs?
I think it's a little bit of both, including the Joint Strike Fighter. You know what I mean? It's not one thing. There's probably, you know, plus or minus $15 million on five variables or six variables that leads to that. Depending on what we did. And you know, we can dial some of that either way, depending on whether we want to accelerate those development programs or not. They're not on the critical path of much of what we do. So, and we will, you know, we'll use it as a lever to determine where we are in the year and decide whether we want to spool it up and accelerate the development of something or whether we want to dial it back, depending on what the testing tells us. So that it's kind of that, you know what I mean? It's you need to have a lever on it. You know, you really do. You need to be able to kind of throttle it depending on what you're finding as you go through these research and development programs. And Chip and the technology folks do a great job of that for us. Cliff?
Last question?
We'll be available afterwards, so.
Are there any particular bottlenecks in your supply chain today? Or which ones do you worry the most about as you get into these increasing production levels pretty much across every type of aircraft?
Yeah.
Castings, you know, hydraulics, anything?
No, Cliff, I tell you, we micromanage this stuff. I mean, we really block and tackle. I worry about the size of the suppliers more than anything else. And we because the health of these suppliers is how much capital they can afford to invest. You know what I mean? Yep. And so, you know, when we need them to ramp, that means they need to have P&E. And to have P&E, they have to be secure enough to have that capital available to themselves. And so we watch that as well as watch the amount of material and everything else to make sure that we've got a robust supply chain that can afford to invest with us when we need to grow. And in some cases, we step in and help them, you know, if we need to, if they're that important of a supplier to us. Terms, loans, whatever we may need to do. But we manage it. So for me, size, there's not a commodity there, Cliff. It's size. And we look at size as well as capability. That plus material. That's honestly where I spend most of my time. Okay. Well, look, thank you all for coming. On behalf of Norm and I, we appreciate it. And we'll be here if you have any other questions. Thanks.